Wing TV with Victor Thorne and Lisa Giuliani. The revolution is being televised.
Hello, it's Tuesday, March 15th, day 7 of 9/11 on trial. I'm Lisa Giuliani, and you're watching Wing TV.
And I'm Victor Thorne. Welcome to Wing TV. We have a couple things to update everybody on before we get started today. First of all, tomorrow morning, that's Wednesday morning at 10 o'clock a.m., we're going to be on the Power Hour with Dave Von Kleist and Joyce Riley. It's one of the hottest shows out there on the radio. So click on to the powerhour.com. It's tomorrow morning, 10 o'clock. We're very much looking forward to that.
Yes, we are.
Also, we just received the rough cut copy of Loose Change by Dylan Avery. We're also going to make this available on DVD when it comes out officially.
And Dylan, we're really proud of you.
Yeah, we did a great job with it, and can't wait to see the final product. Also, we want to say a big thank you to First Amendment Books. As you can see right there, they have four of our books advertised. That's 9/11 On Trial, 9/11 Exposed, The New World Order Exposed, and also The New World Order Illusion, written by Lisa and myself. So thanks to First Amendment Books.
And the American Free Press newspaper.
Exactly, which carries it. Also, some books that we received in the mail. What we do here on Wing TV is we give free plugs to people that send their material here. 9/11, The Fascist State by Don Paul. Also, an excellent book, Murder in Dealey Plaza
by our friend, Professor Jim Fetzer.
Right, and we're going to have him on our show again very soon. Also by Sherry Schreiner, Bible Codes Revealed. And a whole bunch of videos and CD-ROMs that we received from an individual.
Tom Stoneburner.
Correct. And there's OKC Bombing, Prior Knowledge, Creature from Jekyll Island, Terry Schiavo Saga, plus Jim Nichols' first speech, interview with Stanley Monty, also the C-SPAN militia hearings, and last but not least, Deliberately Dumbing Us Down by Charlotte Iserbite. So if you have something out there you want to plug for, send it to us here at Wing TV.
Thanks so much, Tom. We really appreciate it,
right,
too. Okay, we're going to get right to the proceedings. Today we have Witness 5, Daniel Corbett, and the testimony will revolve around jet fuel fires. So let's head to the proceedings with Judge Alan Kirkpatrick.
Please be seated. Court is now in session. Today we will continue with the people's case against the United States federal government in regards to the events of September 11, 2001 at the World Trade Center Towers in New York City. Let us proceed. Witness, do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Your Honor, we would like to welcome today witness number 5, Mr. Daniel Corbett, who's going to speak about the jet fuel fires at the World Trade Center Towers. This is very important because the government's official version of events focuses primarily on the burning jet fuel, which supposedly brought down the towers. Mr. Corbett, question number 1. At what time did Flight 11 hit WTC-1, the North Tower?
At 8:46 a.m.
And at what time did Flight 175 crash in to the second World Trade Center Tower, the South Tower?
At 9:03 a.m.
Now, as we mentioned in earlier testimony, according to government sources, these jetliners were carrying approximately 10,000 gallons of fuel upon takeoff. What happened to this jet fuel upon impact with each of the towers?
The jet fuel created spectacular fireballs when the airplanes crashed, but within a few minutes, most of the flames vanished.
We'll cover this area in more depth a little later, but for the time being, why did the flames vanish so quickly?
The lack of flames is an indication that the fires were small, and the dark smoke is an indication that the fires were suffocating.
And in your opinion, why is that?
The soot and lack of flames can be used as evidence that the fires were suffocating from such a lack of oxygen that they were not capable of damaging such a massive steel structure.
Of course, the government would like us to believe that this fire was a raging inferno. How would you describe it?
The fire in the World Trade Center was an ordinary smoldering office fire.
Very well. In regard to the second tower that was hit, WTC-2, we can see from the video that because Flight 175 hit very much off-center, in fact, right on the corner of the building, what happened to most of the fuel that it was carrying?
Most of Flight 175's fuel burned outside WTC-2. The mass majority of fuel from the second aircraft was ejected out the side of the building, where it burned up immediately in a massive fireball.
Now let's be perfectly clear. Why did this occur?
Whoever was controlling the plane did not manage a direct hit, but rather the plane hit the tower toward a corner and at a shallow angle. Thus, comparatively little of the jet fuel entered the building.
And this phenomenon now is directly due, in your opinion, to the trajectory of the impact with the tower?
As Flight 175 disappeared into the South Tower, it burst like a paper bag full of water. The thousands of pounds of jet fuel were liberated to follow a path directed by the momentum of what had once been an aircraft. So it exploded outside in the open air over the street.
Once again now, we'll cover this topic more fully later in our testimony, but for now, how long were flames visible from the second tower that was hit, the South Tower?
Flames were visible in the South Tower for only a few minutes after the impact.
And did this fire spread rapidly to consume a large portion of the tower?
The fire never spread beyond the impact zone, and then appeared to diminish over time.
Can your response be proven, now I'll repeat, proven by photographs taken on the morning of 9/11?
Yes. Photos show the spectacular flames vanished quickly, and then the fire remained restricted to one area of the tower.
The government, on the other hand, wants us to believe that the fires created such a massive amount of heat that it crippled these steel buildings. But did the fires actually spread throughout the towers?
The flames did not spread beyond its initial starting location. The photos show that not even one floor in the South Tower was above the ignition temperature of plastic and paper.
Okay, as mentioned earlier, let's examine how quickly the fuel inside each plane burned off. To begin, please describe the qualities inherent to liquid fuel.
Liquid fuel does not burn hot for long. Liquid fuel evaporates or boils as it burns, and the vapor burns as it boils off. If the ambient temperature passes the flash point of the fuel and oxygen is plentiful, the process builds to an explosion that consumes all the fuel.
And in your opinion, approximately how long would it have taken for this fuel to either burn off or explode into a fireball?
The jet fuel fires were brief. Most of the jet fuel would have burnt off or evaporated within 30 seconds, and all of it within 2 to 3 minutes.
And if the plane was carrying 10,000 gallons of fuel, how long would the entire burn-off process take?
If all 10,000 gallons of fuel were evenly spread across a single building floor as a pool, it would be consumed by fire in less than 5 minutes.
Would anything else have occurred in relation to the fuel?
The energy from the jet fuel not absorbed by the concrete and steel within this brief period would have been vented to the outside world.
Does the official FEMA report agree with your findings?
Yes. In Chapter 2 of the FEMA report, they write, "The large quantity of jet fuel carried by each aircraft ignited upon impact to each building. A significant portion of this fuel was consumed immediately in the engulfing fireballs. The remaining fuel is believed either to have flowed down through the buildings or to have burned off within a few minutes of the aircraft impact. The heat produced by this burning jet fuel does not, by itself, appear to have been sufficient to initiate these structural collapses."
That's a very important point. The FEMA report does add, though, on the other hand, that the burning jet fuel spread across several floors of the building, ignited the building's contents, and thus created and caused simultaneous fires across several floors of both buildings. The first area I'd like to cover with you in regard to this statement is the temperature of the fires, that it actually reached 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit.
This is impossible because 1,517 degrees Fahrenheit is the maximum temperature of hydrocarbon fires burning in the atmosphere without pressurization or preheating.
In other words, then, the only way it could get hotter than that temperature was if there was pre-mixed fuel in air which could produce blue flames, similar to that used by steel cutters?
Correct.
Now let's make the physics of fire temperatures perfectly clear then.
The melting point of steel is 2,795 degrees Fahrenheit. The highest temperature you can achieve by burning hydrocarbons in the atmosphere without pressurization or preheating of the air is 1,517 degrees Fahrenheit. And that's when you have pre-mixed fuel and air, the kind of blue flame you get with a gas stove.
Would these types of flames be indicative of a structural fire be hotter or cooler than what you described?
Diffuse flames are the type you have in building fires are far cooler than those mentioned above.
And what about oxygen-starved flames?
Oxygen-starved flames are far cooler still.
Now, FEMA's Building Performance Assessment Report states the temperatures at the crash site reached between 1,700 and 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit, so intense that they could have melted the steel girders. In your opinion, is this an accurate assessment?
Author and researcher Eric Huffschmidt has stated, if FEMA's temperatures estimates are correct, the interiors of the towers were furnaces capable of casting aluminum and glazing pottery.
Yet if we look at the photographs taken on the morning of 9/11, we see a blonde-haired woman standing inside of one of the towers at the impact point.
Yes, in the center of the impact hole, there is a blonde standing there, leaning to the right. One must contemplate just how cool the pre-collapse temperatures were at the impact, and presumably the hottest point.
Did firemen on the scene feel that the flames were out of control?
Firemen were able to work for an extended period of time in close proximity and believe the fires they encountered were manageable.
Now, we're going to cover the firemen in much greater depth later, but from what we've encountered so far, this is a far stretch from what the government has described, isn't it?
Kevin Ryan, laboratory director for a South Bend, Indiana firm named Environmental Health Laboratories, Inc., which is, by the way, a subsidiary of the Underwriters Laboratory, Inc., wrote that the Institute's preliminary report suggests that WTC's supports were probably exposed to fires no hotter than 500 degrees, only half of the 1,100-degree temperature needed to forge steel and the 3,000 degrees needed to melt bare steel with no fireproofing.
Now, I'm glad you mentioned Mr. Ryan, because we're going to examine his words more fully later in this trial. But for the time being, what else did Mr. Ryan conclude?
Ryan wrote in an email to Frank Gale, Deputy Chief of the National Institute of Science and Technology's Metallurgy Division, that this story does not add up. He continued, if steel from those buildings did not soften or melt, I'm sure we can all agree that this was certainly not due to the jet fuel fires of any kind, let alone the briefly burning fires in those towers.
Now, I would like to recall from earlier testimony the BBC's official version of events, specifically a statement that was made by structural engineer Chris Weiss. He said, there's nothing on Earth that could survive those temperatures with that amount of fuel burning. Do you feel that his statement is accurate?
No, because we were told that the fires were unimaginably hot infernos, never mind that they were putting out black smoke and you couldn't even see the flames for most part.
Do you have any other areas of contention with the official BBC version of events?
Yes, they stated that 24,000 gallons of aviation fluid melted the steel, when we have clearly seen from the governmental reports that each plane was carrying about a maximum of 10,000 gallons.
And we've referred to photographic evidence in relation to the fires. What more can you tell us about the vast array of photos?
The photos show the fire was not even powerful enough to crack glass. Why do photos show only sooty smoke and black holes? Why is there no evidence of an intense fire in any photograph?
You mean, of course, after the intense fireball?
Yes.
Okay, in your opinion, these photographs don't pan out with the official government story, do they?
For the official theory to be credible, the fires in the towers must have been moderately hot. They must have been large fires spreading throughout the buildings, and they must have burned for a considerable length of time. All the available evidence suggests it's the opposite of what it is.
Now, what is the best indication that these buildings were not consumed by raging infernos?
When we look at the photographs, we see that the dark smoke and lack of flames were an indication that fires did not have enough oxygen to properly burn.
And what would this mean?
This would mean there were no intense fires for the simple reason that there was not enough fuel available to feed such blazes.
When the South Tower was hit, what was happening in the first tower, WTC-1?
In the North Tower, impacted just 16 and a half minutes earlier, the flames had already died down and the copious amounts of thick black smoke were pouring out of the building, indicating a smoldering, oxygen-deprived fire, not a raging inferno. The truth is, there was no concentrated, intense fires burning in either of the towers, as photographs, videotapes, survivor accounts, and the firefighter audio tapes all amply document. The fires had been burning for only 16 minutes, but already most of the flames had not vanished. This skyscraper was not a towering inferno by the time the 16 minutes had passed.
Why is that?
The lack of flames is an indication that the fires were small, and the dark smoke is an indicator that the fires were suffocating.
When we look at these photos that we've referred to of the North Tower, a few minutes after the impact, we only see black holes at the impact point. Why?
There's a reason these holes are black. The reason is there is no fire near the hole.
Do we know why?
The North Tower fires were suffocated because the windows were sealed shut, so the only oxygen available was to the fire was whatever blew in from the broken windows and the hole created by the jet plane.
With the result being what, Mr. Corbett?
Only one floor in the North Tower appeared completely on fire. The fires on the other floors did not spread throughout the floor, nor were the flames visible in many windows. Rather, the flames diminished over time. This implies that the air temperature on all but one of the North Towers was below the ignition temperature of plastic and paper. Therefore, the only columns in that one floor are likely to have reached high temperatures.
Okay, in all fairness, could there have been any other way for the fires to have reached the inferno stage, such as the core columns acting as a chimney?
If one cares to argue that the core structure was acting as a chimney, it is necessary to realize that any catastrophic temperatures which chimneyed would have caused the contents of the upper floor to burn violently, which is not seen in the images.
The smoke we see then is indicative of what?
Again, relatively cool temperatures.
Others have claimed that jet fuel flowed down the elevator shafts and thus spread fire throughout the towers. In your opinion, is this accurate?
The Noddett Brothers videotape demonstrates the lack of any lobby smoke to suggest any amount of jet fuel pouring down a single elevator shaft and burning.
To clarify then, were the World Trade Center elevators one long, continuous shaft?
No. It must be noted that the World Trade Center towers had three independent elevator levels with only one elevator shaft going to the top.
So jet fuel couldn't have spilled unabated from the top to the bottom of this building down a single elevator shaft?
Absolutely not. The only top-to-bottom avenue for central destruction was the 47th core steel columns.
So, if the jet fuel was no longer burning after a minute or two, what does this indicate?
The towers were billowing copious amounts of thick, black smoke, indicative not of raging infernos, but of low intensity smoldering office fires. The great explosions on impact had consumed all the jet fuel in seconds, and now it was plastic fixtures, cabling, and internal partitioning were burning, or smoldering, to be more precise.
Were there any other flammable materials inside the towers?
Carpets, wallpaper, occasional desks, nothing else in the office would produce those temperatures.
Would thick, flammable walls have been a significant contributor?
No. The World Trade Center tower floors were open planned. There were no solid walls.
Okay, how about the central core columns? Could these columns, constructed almost entirely of concrete and high-quality steel, create these massive infernos?
We know that the jet fuel fire was too brief to heat them appreciably.
And why is that?
The central core area contained only a lift shafts and stairwells. It contained very little flammable material.
Which means what?
The core columns could have only been heated by the office fire burning in the adjacent region. Consequently, the core columns would have never gotten hot enough to fall.
And how do we know that?
We already know this because they did not fall in the 1975 World Trade Center office fire.
Did FEMA's final report agree with your analysis?
In Chapter 2 of their final report, FEMA wrote, "It is well known that the maximum temperature that can be reached by a non-stoichiometric hydrocarbon burns, that is, hydrocarbon, like jet fuel, burning in the air, is 1,520 degrees Fahrenheit. The World Trade Center fires were fuel-rich, as evidenced by the thick black smoke, and thus did not reach anywhere near the upper limit of this 1,520 degrees Fahrenheit. In fact, the World Trade Center fires would have burned at or below temperatures of typical office fires."
Did they comment any further about this?
Yes, a significant portion of jet fuel was consumed immediately in the ensuing fireballs. The remaining fuel is believed either to have flown down the building or have to burned off within a few minutes after the aircraft impact. The heat produced by this burning jet fuel does not by itself appear to have been sufficient to initiate the structural collapse.
And when the South Tower fell at 9:59 in the morning, after burning for only 56 minutes, what did we see?
All the black smoke.
What did the few survivors who managed to escape from the upper floors say about these fires?
Well, if you get, I just need to grab my transcripts. And
okay, feel free. The first person is Stanley Clark. What did he say?
Stanley Clark, a survivor from the 84th floor of the WTC-2, you could see through the wall in the cracks and see flames just licking up. Not a roaring inferno, just quiet flames licking up in smoke.
Okay, how about Donovan Cowan?
In an open elevator on the 78th floor, Sky Lobby, we went into the elevator. As soon as I hit the button, that's when there was a big boom. We both got knocked down. I remembered feeling this intense heat. The doors were still open. The heat lasted for maybe 15 to 20 seconds, I guess. Then it stopped.
Okay, finally, how about Ling Young, who's on the 78th floor of this office building?
Only in my area were people alive, and the people alive were from my office, I figured. That out later because I sat around there for 10 or 15 minutes. That's how I got so burned.
All right, thank you for that testimony. My next question is, if somebody was on the 78th floor of World Trade Center Tower Number 2 in the middle of a raging inferno that structural engineer Chris Weiss described as, "Nothing on earth could survive those temperatures," would somebody be able to sit around for 10 or 15 minutes then ultimately escape?
Thomas Eagar claims temperatures were hot enough to cause the truces of the South Tower to fall. But here, we have eyewitnesses stating that the temperatures were cool enough for them to walk away.
Plus, we have to remember the photograph of the blonde woman standing inside the World Trade Center at its impact point. Likewise, what did firemen on the scene have to say about these fires?
Cool temperatures in the collision area were also confirmed by an audio tape indicating that the firefighters reached the area of crash damage in the South Tower and reported survivable temperatures there.
And how close to the fires did these firemen get?
The New York Times recently revealed that at least two of the men had reached the 78th floor sky lobby of the South Tower.
And what did they do upon reaching this area?
The firefighters reported on the fires and casualties they encountered and began evacuating the survivors.
Who were these firemen, do you know?
Battalion Chief Oreo J. Palmer, who was organizing the evacuation of the injured people, and Fire Marshal Ronald P. Buca.
Did these men survive?
Both men died in the collapse.
And how do we know these details?
A tape of radio conversations between firefighters exists, but only relatives of the dead men have been allowed to hear it.
Why is that?
The United States Department of Justice has ordered secrecy measures to keep the contents of a lost tape of firefighters' voices at the World Trade Center Tower from becoming available to the public.
Do we know why they're doing that?
The reason for the secrecy surrounding the 78-minute audio tape is because it evidently debunks the accepted explanation that intense jet fuel fires melted the towers, steel beams, and caused the collapse.
Do we know exactly what is on those audio tapes?
Yes, we do.
And we will divulge their contents in a few minutes. But first, Daniel, what have those people said who have listened to these tapes?
The widow of firefighter Oriel Palmer said, "I don't hear fear. I don't hear panic." Also, a reporter from the New York Times wrote, "The voices of the firefighters showed no panic, no sense that the events were racing beyond their control." At that point, the building would be standing for just a few more minutes as the fire was weakening the structure on the floors above him. Even so, Chief Palmer could only see two pockets of fire and called for a pair of engine companies to fight them.
Okay, being that these firemen reached the crash site, how would you characterize this situation?
Being that these veteran firefighters had a coherent plan for putting out two pockets of fire indicates they judged the blazes to be manageable.
Does this correspond to the government's version of events, that it was a raging inferno?
No. These reports from the scene of the crash provide crucial evidence debunking the government's claims that a raging steel-melting inferno led to the tower's collapse.
What can you tell us about the huge discrepancy, then, between FEMA's official report and what the firemen said on this audio tape?
According to Eric Huffschmidt, if FEMA's estimates are correct, the interiors of the tower were furnaces capable of casting aluminum and glazing pottery. Yet the voices on the tape prove that several firefighters were able to work without fear for an extended period of time at the point of the crash, and that the fires they encountered were neither intense nor large.
Okay, before we look at the content of this 78-minute audio tape, please give us a lead-in in what we should expect.
The fire within the South Tower appeared so manageable that NYFD Battalion Chief Orion J. Palmer asked for more engines and firefighters at 9:48 a.m., 11 minutes before the tower began to explode. Having reached the 78th floor sky lobby with the fire marshal, Ronald P. Buca Palmer, reported two pockets of fire.
If they felt this building was going to collapse, was it official company policy then to report such an impending danger to prevent other firemen from approaching the scene?
They would have been the ones reporting this information, but instead they reported on isolated fires immediately before the building's collapse.
Did any firefighters other than Palmer and Buca reach the 78th floor?
Yes. Kevin Flynn of the New York Times reported this conversation from the audio tape. It is Lieutenant Joseph G. Levy of Ladder Company 15 telling Palmer, "Oreo, we're on 77, but we are in B stairway, trapped in here. We got to put out some fire to get to you."
So more than one battalion reached what the government has described as a raging inferno.
Correct.
And what time was this?
At 9:56 a.m.
That would be 3 minutes, only 3 minutes before the South Tower collapsed.
Correct.
All right. Could you read a portion of this audio tape?
Yeah. "Oreo Palmer, Battalion 7, Ladder 15, we've got two isolated pockets of fire. We should be able to knock it down with two lines. Radio that 78th floor, numerous 1045 code ones."
Then Joseph Levy says what?
"Chief, what stair are you in?"
And Oreo Palmer replies,
"South stairway, Adam, South Tower."
Joseph Levy responds,
"Floor 78.
Which is returned by Oreo Palmer, who says,
10-4, numerous civilians, we're going to need two engines up here."
Okay, two engines up there. Oreo Palmer continues then by saying what?
"I'm going to need two of your firefighters, Adam, stairway, to knock down two fires. We have a house line stretched. We could use some water on it. Knock it down, Kay."
Okay, and finally, Joseph Levy responds by saying,
"All right, 10-4, we're coming up to the stairs. We're on 77 now in B stair. I'll be right to you."
Okay, to bring this to a close, from this audio tape, why do you feel that Lieutenant Levy was heading directly to meet Battalion Chief Palmer?
The reason that the firefighters bolted up the stairwell was that they were totally certain that there was no danger of collapse. They had no fear, and one may go to the transcripts of the radio traffic for evidence of their associated faith and courage.
In your opinion, Daniel, why do you feel they had so much confidence?
Steel buildings just don't collapse from fire damage.
And my final question is, how do you know this?
Because fire has never caused a steel building to collapse.
Thank you, Mr. Corbett. Your Honor, no further questions.